KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Americans buy lots of cars made in Europe, which could be getting more expensive. We asked Germany's finance minister how they're preparing for new tariffs on all vehicles made outside the U.S. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. President Trump wants to get rid of what he calls divisive ideology from museums run by the Smithsonian. May Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. What types of exhibits are being targeted, and how could it change how American history is told? Also, France's far-right leader Marine Le Pen is barred from running for office for 5 years after being found guilty of embezzlement. And Tennessee Republicans want schools to block students in the country illegally. It is Monday, March 31st. On this day in 1968, President Lyndon B. Johnson announced he would not run for another term. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Stocks open lower this morning as investors brace for more tariff announcements this week. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell about 180 points in early trading.
President Trump's new tariffs on cars and car parts are set to take effect this week. The president's also promised an announcement on what he's calling reciprocal tariffs, which could add additional taxes on imports from some of the nation's biggest trading partners. Gasoline prices are climbing as refiners make the switch to more expensive summer blends of fuel. AAA reports the average price of regular gas is about $3.17 a gallon, a nickel more than a month ago. Gas is still much cheaper than this time last year, however, thanks in part to tepid demand. The online mortgage company Rocket is buying rival Mr. Cooper in a stock deal valued at more than $9 billion. Rocket's been on a buying spree. It recently announced plans to acquire the Redfin real estate brokerage. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump is floating the idea of potentially serving a third term in the White House. But NPR's Tamara Keith reports the Constitution says no one can be elected more than twice to the office of the presidency.
The way he talks about a third term, it's like he's keeping his options open. He also said it is still quite early to be having these conversations. The 22nd Amendment bars a president from being elected to a third term. But there are some novel legal theories that have been floated, and while they are quite far-fetched, the fact that Trump isn't dismissing it out of hand means it can't be ignored.
NPR's Tamara Keith reporting. At the U.S. Supreme Court today, the justices will hear arguments in a case testing whether the group Catholic Charities is entitled to opt out of a state unemployment compensation system for employees. NPR's Nina Totenberg explains.
Today's case was brought by a single chapter of Catholic Charities in northern Wisconsin. It claims that it should be exempt from the mandatory state unemployment compensation system and that it should be allowed to join an alternative church system, which is cheaper. The state, however, refused to grant Catholic Charities an exemption, arguing that because Catholic Charities hires and serves both Catholics and non-Catholics alike, and because it explicitly forbids proselytizing, it is required to participate in the state unemployment compensation system, as it has done for decades. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
The devastation from the major earthquake in Myanmar is still unfolding. The country's military junta says more than 1,700 people have been killed by Friday's tremor. Thousands of others are injured. Reports from the epicenter say much of the city of Mandalay is wrecked. The quake was felt far to the south in neighboring Thailand. At least 18 people there were killed, too. A Thai building hundreds of miles away from the epicenter collapsed. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are now down 125 points. This is NPR. President Trump is repeating his desire to take over Greenland. In an interview, he said there was a good possibility the U.S. could do it, quote, without military force. Greenland's new prime minister is pushing back strongly. Prime Minister Jens Frederik Nielsen says he wants to be clear the United States will not get Greenland, that Greenlanders will decide their own future because they don't belong to anyone else. Thousands of people turned out in Texas yesterday to protest the Trump administration's immigration policies. That includes the deportation of those in the U.S. without legal status. From member station KERA, Priscilla Rice reports demonstrators marched in downtown Dallas.
Shouts of "Si se puede," yes you can, echoed across downtown Dallas as demonstrators carried signs reading "Rise up" and "No one is illegal." Dallas resident Malu Piñon Castro grew up in Dallas, but her parents were born in Mexico. She says as the Trump administration talks about boosting deportations, it's causing fear among families.
We want our country to survive. My children were born here. My parents fought for us to be in this country.
This year's event fell short of the 500,000 people who attended the first mega march in 2006, but organizers are still calling it a success. For NPR News, I'm Priscilla Rice in Dallas.
A powerful thunderstorm is hitting parts of the South this morning. The National Weather Service says that it has put areas near New Orleans under a flash flood warning. Again, on Wall Street, the stocks are lower. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Coming up, a historian reacts to President Trump's push to reshape what art and history is highlighted by the Smithsonian. But first, the Trump administration's 25% tariffs on foreign cars and parts go into effect this week. Germany is the biggest car manufacturer country in Europe. In 2023, it produced more than 4 million vehicles. Here to discuss how Germany and German companies are preparing, we call German Finance Minister Jörg Kukies. So, Minister, President Trump says these tariffs are meant to boost American manufacturing. Do you expect German car makers maybe to open up more factories here or increase productions at the ones that are already here?
Yeah, first of all, the German manufacturers have a lot of factories in the United States already. BMW in Spartanburg, Mercedes, VW are some of the biggest car producers in the United States and actually are among the leading exporters of cars of the U.S. And of course, they're constantly adjusting the global supply chain. But at the end, it's of course their business decision to decide on capacities in the United States.
So it's not something that Germany would maybe try and encourage these car companies to try and do more in the United States. I know there are 5 total assembly plants for German cars in the U.S.
Well, we always encourage trade and investments between the United States and the U.S. in general. But of course, individual business decisions by companies is not something where we would get involved in as a government.
I know the European Union has a 10% tariff on imported American cars. Would Germany be able to ask the EU to lower that somehow?
Well, in the document that drives the coalition discussions between the two parties that are forming a government at the moment, there is a sentence in there that says we would like a free trade agreement between the United States and the European Union. And so we could even envisage going down and all the way to zero tariffs where both sides would levy no tariffs. So that's imaginable, but of course needs to be negotiated.
How likely do you think that is? It sounds like it would be a difficult scenario based on the current circumstances, the way it is right now between the United States and everyone else.
Yeah, we're not naive. Congress would have to approve any reduction in tariffs from the U.S. side, but that is completely up to negotiations, and maybe a symmetric reduction would also be possible. Then, of course, tariffs isn't the only thing that would be discussed and negotiated, also the non-tariff issues around trade. So at the end, if there is a negotiation, there would, of course, have to be a comprehensive package that includes tariffs, that includes non-trade, and that could potentially also include investment commitments.
So I read a German spokesman on Friday say that, quote, nothing is off the table in terms of retaliating against the U.S. What is being considered?
Well, first of all, the clear position of the German government is that, first of all, we should negotiate before talking about retaliation. But of course, everyone knows that if a negotiation doesn't work, then retaliation is, of course, always a possibility. And that's something during my visit to Washington that many of the companies that I talked to are also keenly aware of, because, of course, also the European market is very attractive to U.S. companies.
How do you think all of this will affect the German economy?
Well, we are very externally oriented. The United States, since last year, is again our biggest global trading partner. So far before that, it was China. Now the U.S., due to our de-risking strategy from China, now the United States is our biggest trading partner. So, of course, it would have a very substantial impact. But at the moment, of course, given that there is still openness to negotiations, we can only speculate because, of course, it depends on exactly what the type and structure of tariffs is that end up being levied.
Well, what's the worst way you think Germany would suffer from this?
Well, it's hard to speculate about numbers because the 2nd of April is still yet to come, and there has been announcements. And before we don't know what will be on the table, it's impossible to give you a number of how that would affect GDP, employment, wages, etc. I mean, that would be pure speculation.
Do you expect German car makers maybe to sell less to America and more to other parts of the world where tariffs aren't as high?
Well, I mean, one of the key responses that Germany encourages the European Union to do as the largest member state is, of course, to accelerate the agreements on free trade agreements with the rest of the world, right? I mean, Mercosur, the Latin American free trade area is a partner of the EU. And of course, one of the attractions of the agreement between the EU and Mercosur, which Germany strongly supports, is that then tariffs would be reduced between the EU and Latin America. There's negotiations ongoing with India, Indonesia, many other parts of the world, and we can only encourage and keep encouraging the EU to sign deals with those parts of the world.
That's German Finance Minister Jörg Kukies. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Back here in the U.S., President Donald Trump wants to make changes at the Smithsonian Institution. He signed an executive order last week titled Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History. It directs Vice President J.D. Vance to eliminate, quote, improper, divisive, anti-American ideology, unquote, from its museums. The Smithsonian includes 21 museums and galleries, the National Zoo, and 9 research facilities. It is not a federal agency, but it does get federal funding, and some employees are civil servants. We called James Grossman for his perspective on this. He is the executive director of the American Historical Association, which promotes the work of historians in public life. Good morning, Mr. Grossman.
Good morning, and I am actually at a conference in Berlin right now. I just heard your previous conversation.
Well, that's great to hear. So what was your reaction to this executive order? What do you think the president's trying to do here?
Well, those are two very different and important questions. My first reaction to the executive order was, this is silly. Most of this is untrue. It completely misunderstands, it misrepresents the work of the Smithsonian Institution, and it completely misconstrues the nature of historical work itself. So that's one part of it, which is it's just off base. Most of what it accuses the Smithsonian of doing, the Smithsonian is not doing. There is first-class historical work being done at the Smithsonian, and scientific work as well. That's not my field.
Mm-hmm.
Your second question is, what do I think the president is trying to do? I'm a historian. Historians are very careful at attributing intent to people. But I think what is going on here is part of an agenda that's been, we've seen for three or four years in state legislatures as well. A lot of the language in this executive order comes straight out of legislation that's been introduced in various states. Much of it written by conservative foundations. Some of it comes straight from Fifth Avenue in New York. And what they're trying to do, I think, is to suggest that we as a nation are better off ignoring our history. They want to erase from American history all the things that we shouldn't be proud of. And you can't do that.
Let me jump in here, because one of the examples the White House points to of what it calls divisive anti-American ideology is an exhibit at the American Art Museum called The Shape of Power, about sculpture, race, and identity.
Yes.
There are other examples we don't have room to list. People can, you know, check that out if they are interested. But what do you make of the examples the administration cited? Is the operative idea here that discussions of race and identity are inherently divisive and therefore unpatriotic?
Well, first of all, what you have to do is think about what patriotism means. And for me, and for most thinking historians, patriotism is helping Americans to learn what they need to learn to be good citizens and to contribute to democratic institutions. When Benjamin Franklin said, "A republic, if you can keep it," he was not saying, "Let's keep the republic by keeping people ignorant." You cannot ignore, directly to your question, you cannot ignore the impact of race on American economic institutions, cultural institutions, social institutions. So to say that race has been an important part of the history of the United States and other countries, that's crazy.
But I think the idea here seems to be that these discussions make people feel less than
yes.
positive about the country, and that is divisive of the social fabric. Do you have any sympathy for that idea?
I have sympathy. Sympathy is the wrong word. I am interested in all ideas. And I think the important thing is to help people who have those concerns to interact with people in thinking about history, with people who have other different understandings of American history. You simply cannot ignore the fact, and this is not a theory, it's a fact, that the United States is divided by race. That's just a fact. And we have been divided by race for a long time. You can't ignore the fact that power has been distributed unequally in the United States, in part along racial lines. So we want to understand it. That's the point. We don't want to propagandize people. We want to understand it and help other people to understand it.
Before we let you go, is there a sense of what might change for researchers and for people who visit exhibits or draw on the Smithsonian's research?
I hope not. The Smithsonian does good work. And I would not want to see the White House or the Congress or any other or any of the branches of government interfere with the quality of scholarship at the Smithsonian. Smithsonian has an international reputation for the integrity of its research.
And before we let you, we have about 30 seconds left. So mentioning that you are overseas at a conference, so presumably in your field, are you hearing from members of your organization in response to this, and what are they saying?
They're saying, please help defend the Smithsonian. They do good work.
That is James Grossman. He's the executive director of the American Historical Association. And as he mentioned, we reached him at a conference in Berlin. Mr. Grossman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, British actor Stephen Graham, who's starring in two new shows. In the Hulu series A Thousand Blows, he plays a real-life bare-knuckle boxer fighting in Victorian London. And in Netflix's Adolescence, he plays the father of a 13-year-old boy arrested for murdering a classmate. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Workday. Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits. At progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. The far-right frontrunner in France's 2027 presidential election was effectively barred from running in the contest today. That's after a criminal court in Paris found Marine Le Pen guilty of embezzling European Union funds for her party and barred her from running for political office for 5 years. She was also sentenced to prison and was fined 100,000 euros or around $108,000. It was also a blow to her far-right party, the National Rally. It had styled itself as an honest alternative to corrupt politicians of old. Le Pen's attorney says she plans to appeal. For more on all this, Sylvain Bourmont joins us now from Paris. He's a professor at the Sorbonne. He's also the editor of AOC Media. That's an analysis and opinion website. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello, you're welcome.
So what exactly were the accusations against Le Pen and other National Rally members? And if you can just tell us a little bit about what the evidence was against them.
Yes, they were found guilty of embezzlement by a criminal court in Paris today. What they did is that they used for several years, it lasted for quite a long while, European money, European public money from the European Parliament in order to fund a French political organization, their political party.
So how might the verdict affect voter support for the far right?
Well, it's a very strong blow, not just against Marine Le Pen, but there were 25 people involved, and also the political party itself has been found guilty, and so the Rassemblement National has to give 2 million, 1 million firm. I mean, so it's a lot of people that were actually banned from running in all kinds of elections in France. Either national or local elections for the next 5 years for some of them, including Marine Le Pen, and others just 3 years.
So this isn't just about her. I think I hear you saying that this affects kind of the movement. Le Pen has spent more than a decade trying to make the far right more mainstream in French politics. Do you have a sense of whether this decision affects that effort?
Well, it will simply be impossible for her to run as a presidential candidate for the next election, which is normally scheduled in 2027. But apart from that, it will be difficult for other people in the same party. Actually, what happens is it's just a rule of law. I mean, what the judges have decided is not the fact that she would run or not. I mean, they just decided that she and other people in the party and the party itself were guilty of using fraudulently that money. The consequence is the fact that she will not be able to run. But this is not actually the decision itself. It's only a consequence of the fact that she was found guilty.
Before we let you go very briefly, what does this mean for the 2027 presidential election? She says, her lawyer says she plans to appeal. Are there any other likely candidates who might have some traction?
Well, of course, the current president of the organization, Jordan Bardella, is maybe the natural candidate now. But I guess there will be other people as well. I mean, this situation will probably create quite a strange situation in the party. So we'll see what happens.
Okay, that is the journalist, Sylvain Bourmeau. Mr. Bourmeau, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth paid his first visit to Japan over the weekend. One goal was to try to ease worries that an America First policy would mean abandoning allies. But as NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports, Hegseth's language may have triggered other concerns.
On Saturday, U.S. veterans in their 90s and above paid their respects at a memorial on the island of Iwoto, known in the post-war years as Iwo Jima. Defense Secretary Hegseth, Prime Minister Shigeru Ishiba, and other U.S. and Japanese officials watched the ceremony. The battle took place 80 years ago this month near the end of World War II. It resulted in 6,800 U.S. Marines killed and some 18,500 Japanese dead. At a Sunday press conference in Tokyo, Secretary Hegseth and his Japanese counterpart Gen Nakatani said they had agreed to strengthen their alliance. Hegseth was clear what it's for.
America and Japan stand firmly together in the face of aggressive and coercive actions by the communist Chinese.
Hegseth said that the U.S. had begun upgrading its 55,000-strong military presence in Japan into a joint forces command. He put it this way.
This also means reorganizing U.S. Forces Japan into a warfighting headquarters.
Hegseth specified that the focus of deterring China would be to prevent it from attacking Taiwan. Asked whether Japanese troops would fight with the U.S. in such a scenario, Defense Minister Gen Nakatani replied,
In any case, we will be considering this specific response based on the Constitution, international law, and our domestic legislation.
By contrast with his host's vague and neutral language,
Hegseth, when he was here, he used some very belligerent language.
Jeffrey Hall is an expert on Japanese politics at Kandai University of International Studies near Tokyo.
He referred to Japan being at the front lines of a potential conflict over Taiwan, calling Japan a country with a warrior ethos.
Japan's laws limit its use of military force to defending Japan and its allies. It doesn't want to unnecessarily provoke China by calling it an enemy. And despite its military buildup, it doesn't want to signal to its public that it's going to war anytime soon. Hall adds that for now, Japan has little choice but to stay aligned with the U.S., even as the Trump administration hits it with tariffs.
Japan just has to get through these next 4 years and hope that the next administration is much more cooperative and willing to not engage in economic warfare against Japan and bring things back to the status quo pre-Trump.
So for now, Hall says, despite U.S. promises of protection, Japan is left with a feeling of uncertainty. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Beijing.
This is NPR News.
A Biden-era program allowing more than 200,000 Ukrainians to come to the U.S. was halted by President Trump. Now, thousands of Ukrainians in the U.S. face an uncertain future.
Ukrainians, we cannot create any plans for our lives because of this situation. Like, we cannot live full life.
Planning for a future on pause. On All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Trump's latest tariffs on U.S. imports of foreign-made goods are set to take effect this week. They include 25% tariffs on cars and auto parts. Canada, as well as countries in Europe, are pledging to respond in kind. Economists warn the auto levies will add thousands of dollars to the cost of many new vehicles sold in the U.S. Currently, the average close to $50,000. NPR's Luke Garrett says among those supporting the tariffs is the leadership of the United Auto Workers.
United Auto Workers President Sean Fain tells CBS News he supports Trump's auto tariffs.
Tariffs aren't the total solution. Tariffs are a tool in the toolbox to get these companies to do the right thing.
Fain hopes companies will bring workers back to U.S. manufacturing plants in response to the duty on foreign-made cars and parts.
I've had companies tell us point blank that they're going to have to bring product back here if those tariffs are implemented.
But some analysts say automakers may not be able to make those changes to scale up U.S. production so easily. Despite his agreement with Trump on tariffs, Fain criticized President Trump for signing an executive order last week that seeks to end collective bargaining for many federal workers. Luke Garrett, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump says he's not joking about possibly serving a third term in the White House, despite the constitutional limits. This is NPR News. Major League Baseball fans are buzzing about the New York Yankees after the Bronx Bombers hit a team record 9 home runs in Saturday's win over the Milwaukee Brewers. NPR's Mansi Khanna says a lot of attention is being given to a torpedo-shaped bat with a larger handle being used by some members of the Yankees.
5 of the home runs were scored using the bat, according to ESPN. The Yankees won the game 20-9. A spokesperson for Major League Baseball has said the bat does meet the league standards. And it was used again in Sunday's game against the Brewers, which the Yankees won 12-3. Mansi Khanna, NPR News.
This year's Final Four in the NCAA men's basketball tournament will feature the bracket's 4 top seeds, Houston, Duke, Florida, and Auburn. It marks the first time that's happened in more than 15 years. The men's Final Four is being played at the Alamo Dome in San Antonio. The semifinals are Saturday. Houston plays Duke and Auburn battles Florida. The championship game is a week from tonight. In the women's bracket, top seeds UCLA and South Carolina have advanced to the Final Four. The other 2 teams have yet to be decided. The women's Final Four is being played in Tampa, Florida. The championship game is on Sunday. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. And from American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice. At ajws.org. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Ami Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Myanmar's military authorities say the death toll from Friday's earthquake has risen to more than 1,700, with thousands more wounded, numbers that are expected to rise as the window for finding survivors closes.
While some foreign assistance has started to arrive in the country, efforts to get help to those who need it may have been stymied by buckled roads, collapsed bridges, and downed cell towers that make communication difficult.
Reporter Michael Sullivan has been following the relief effort from neighboring Thailand. Hello, Michael.
Good morning.
So what do we know about the damage so far?
Well, the pictures we're seeing coming out of Mandalay are pretty awful. It's Myanmar's second largest city, about 10 miles from the epicenter, and those pictures show many parts of the city of 1.5 million in ruins. And efforts to free those trapped under the rubble have been hampered by a lack of heavy equipment and personnel. And time is running short for finding more survivors, especially with the temperature hovering near 100 degrees, and the smell of death, rescue workers say, is overpowering. Here's a retired teacher from Mandalay. She doesn't want to be identified. She's afraid of the military. My house was badly damaged, she says, so now we're sleeping out here in the road. A hot pot shop near my house just disappeared into the earth, she says. And many, many big buildings just collapsed. We cannot count how many have died. And this is just in Mandalay, Michelle. There's other area rescuers haven't been able to reach.
What has been the military government's response? Have they reached out to other countries for help?
They have, and that's unusual, and maybe a sign they realize how bad things are. It's something they've been loath to do in past crises, especially in 2008, when Cyclone Nargis struck and left about 140,000 dead. Emergency response teams from China, India, and Russia, and some other countries have arrived in country, but the airport in Mandalay, it's still closed to large aircraft, and that means much of the foreign assistance is being flown into the former capital, Yangon, some 350 miles to the south. That's a long way from Mandalay. President Trump said on Friday the U.S. will be helping too, but we're still waiting to see just how. USAID has played a large role in disaster relief in the past, but it's been gutted by the Trump administration in recent weeks.
And, you know, you've reminded us that this is just the latest problem for the people of Myanmar because they're in the midst of a civil war.
That's right. I mean, this war has been raging since the 2021 coup, and it's crippled Myanmar's public health system. It's displaced millions and severely restricted the distribution of aid for those people and for others as well. The UN says nearly 20 million people were in need of humanitarian assistance, and roughly 15 million were facing acute food insecurity. That's before the quake.
And there have been calls for a ceasefire from abroad and from some of the groups battling the military. So is the conflict on hold to deal with this tragedy?
No. In fact, just hours after the quake, the military launched airstrikes and drone attacks in Karen State, according to relief workers, and reportedly launched several more airstrikes on Sunday against another rebel-controlled area in neighboring Shan State. The war goes on, even as the death toll from the quake continues to rise.
That is reporter Michael Sullivan in Thailand. Michael, thank you.
You're welcome.
Republicans in Tennessee are trying to end the federal right to education for undocumented students by allowing schools to refuse students without legal status. Mariana Bacchiao of member station WPLN in Nashville reports on a bill challenging Supreme Court precedent.
It's a strategy that has worked for Republicans in the past. The reversal of Roe v. Wade and the federal right to abortion started with a Mississippi state law. Tennessee Representative William Lamberth says that his legislation will be the first step in overturning Plyler v. Doe, the 1982 Supreme Court case that established the right to an education for all students, regardless of immigration status.
If they don't like that, they can go to some state that's a sanctuary state, but we're not going to take money away from the educational system that is there for legal residents and U.S. citizens and educate children that are illegal immigrants. That's just where we stand on the issue.
Lamberth isn't just expecting a lawsuit. He's counting on it to bring the issue back to the courts. That move has become part of the Republican strategy, especially with the conservative lean on the court, says Stella Yarbrough, the legal director of Tennessee's ACLU.
If they can tee up challenges to cases that were close calls, I think that they are correct, that they are going to get a second bite at the apple.
Despite the nationwide risk, Yarbrough says it's important to continue challenging potential laws like this one.
Even if you think you're going to lose in the long run, putting off that loss, even for a day, a week, a year, can be meaningful.
For some kids without legal status, those years could mean making it to graduation or hitting crucial learning milestones. But immigrant families and their allies are doing what they can to stop the bill before it passes. Protesters have bussed into Nashville from all over the state in record numbers to lobby against the bill as it makes its way through the state house.
Every kid counts! Every kid counts!
Most hearings for Lambert's bill have been met with hundreds of protesters crowded into overflow rooms and spilling out into the hallway. Earlier this month, sixth grader Damian Felipe Jimenez testified before a House Education Subcommittee urging lawmakers to vote no.
I am the son of immigrant parents that have shown me to respect and value everyone. Just like me and all the kids in this country, we have the right to dream and make those dreams come true. The right to an education should not be taken away from us because of our immigration status.
Addressing the committee afterwards, Lamberth argued that until the legal immigration process is fixed at the federal level,
it is false hope to give children the best education available in the world and then tell them that they can be licensed professionals, they can be doctors, they can be lawyers, they can be accountants, they could run for office, because it is not true. If they are illegally present, their dreams at some point will have a ceiling, and that is inappropriate.
But some undocumented students can become doctors or lawyers, either in other countries or in the U.S. under the DACA program, which allows kids brought to the U.S. illegally to stay in the country and attend college and work. The committee ultimately advanced the legislation, but with more Republicans voting no than expected. And lawmakers had to adjourn early because of cries from the crowd. At a rally afterwards, protesters took that as a win.
Cerramos un comité. We adjourned the committee. That was people power. That was not their own decision. That was our community doing that.
And as they left the Tennessee Capitol, hundreds of protesters chanted, so far, it hasn't been an empty promise. As the bill gets closer to passing, neither side is losing steam. For NPR News in Nashville, I'm Mariana Baca-Yao.
This is NPR News. The Supreme Court is hearing a major case Monday about religion and whether a charity connected to a church has to pay certain taxes. That's next time in Here and Now.
You're about to step out the door. You've got your keys, your wallet, and NPR. If you have your smartphone, we are with you. Listen live at this station's website or npr.org.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. It happens to many of us. If you're late on a deadline, you gotta pay, even if you're a city. That's what happened to Gothenburg in Sweden for not switching to renewable energy fast enough. The city took out a loan 3 years ago. It gets discounts if it hits certain targets like electrifying government-owned cars, but if it misses, the loan fees increase, which is what happened last year, and now the tab is about $15,000. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America, From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. The NCAA Men's Basketball Final Four is set. Auburn Tigers take on Florida. Duke plays Houston in the other semifinal matchup. The finalists are all number one seeds, something that's only happened once since 1985. Here to talk about the Cinderella Free Final Four, we're joined by Anscape's Jesse Washington. So the biggest surprise, Jesse, was that there's no surprise, right? All one seeds in the Final Four. What happened?
Yeah, I think Cinderella has vanished into the transfer portal is what happened. You know, this new era of college basketball that we're in with freedom of movement for the players, abundant NIL payments at the top schools, the best players gravitate to these great schools and end up top heavy in a tournament like this with all the number one seeds making it. You know, in past years, Iona might have been our Cinderella because that's where the Florida senior transcendent guard Walter Clayton Jr. started his career. But in this era, he transferred to Florida. He powered them to the Final Four as a number one seed. So that's what we're looking at.
So Duke is led by Cooper Flagg, well, one of college basketball's most exciting players. I mean, is he the best at the college level? By the way, he's also got a great name, Cooper Flagg. I mean, my goodness.
Yeah, I think he is the best player in college basketball. He's terrific, 6'9", can do everything, has started to dominate toward the end of the year. But Duke's supporting cast is also amazing. You know, Konka Nipple is great. Duke is looking loaded.
All right, let's talk about Auburn. So that's the only team, actually, they've been in the Final Four once before, 2019. But for the longest time, Jesse, I mean, Auburn was really just more of a football school than a basketball school. So what's changed for them?
Bruce Pearl has really elevated this program. The coach, you know, he's been around. He's been in some trouble. He's gotten out of some trouble. Now he's in the Final Four trying to win it for the first time. You know, they got a great older, which is another aspect of college basketball that's new, star player, Jani Broom, power forward, sort of a throwback player, been around the block a few times. He's sort of the yin to Cooper Flagg's yang in terms of an older player who's really good. And so Auburn is no longer just football.
Yeah, so that's what we're seeing then, right? I mean, all these powerhouse schools are kind of getting smaller schools, older players that are really good, but maybe won't have much of a championship future on those teams. So they transfer over, and all of a sudden, the rich keep getting richer.
The rich are abundantly rich in this year's tournament. You know, and on one hand, people like Cinderella stories and the excitement of an underdog. But whenever the lesser schools get into the Final Four, the ratings go down. And so now we got big names, we got big fan bases. So it should make for a very popular and exciting Final Four.
Now, on the women's side, two number one seeds already in, UCLA and South Carolina. They're in the Final Four. Two number one seeds play tonight, Texas and USC. I'm apologizing, Jesse, to the state of Connecticut and to the rest of the country. I want to see USC and UCLA, two LA schools, in the Final Four somehow.
Yeah, I can't blame you. That would be a great matchup. They've already had some epic battles this season. Unfortunately, USC's transcendent star, Juju Watkins, went down with an ACL injury. So, you know, we won't see her in that game. And if UCLA can kind of get over this hump, because SC has had their number for the most part, then it might be with a little asterisk on it because Juju's not there. But any way you slice it, that would be a terrific, terrific Final Four battle on the women's side.
I get to keep my L.A. card, Jesse, for wanting a UCLA-USC Final Four somehow. All right, that's Anscape's Jesse Washington. Jesse, thanks as always.
Appreciate you. Thanks.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
More tariffs, more fear.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance. On the road and at home, customers can simplify their insurance needs and protect what's important by bundling home and auto with Progressive Insurance. Learn more about Progressive and bundling at progressive.com. And by the Financial Times, whose pink pages encourage fearless thinking on American news. There's more at ft.com.
From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishore, in for David Brancaccio. President Trump over the weekend said a wave of new tariffs set to be announced on Wednesday will cover basically all countries. These are what the administration's been calling reciprocal tariffs. Markets are down here and globally. Markets Places, Nova Sappho has more.
Whatever tariffs are introduced this week, they'll come on top of other import taxes already announced on vehicles, steel and aluminum, Chinese goods, and on a portion of the trade coming from Mexico and Canada. All of this has investors worried about uncertainty, says George Lagarius, chief economist at Forvis Mazar.
We're just in the very beginning of it, and any person with any sense of history and any sense of markets knows that there are no certain outcomes on which you can make bets. So the market is all over the place.
Investors are fleeing for perceived safer havens, such as gold, where prices have risen at their quickest pace in nearly 40 years. And bonds, where higher prices are sending yields lower. Ironically, that could be good news in the short term for those looking to take out a home loan or buy a car, as falling treasury yields push down consumer interest rates. Over the long term, analysts at Goldman Sachs just increased the probability of a U.S. recession from 20% to 35%. That's because data is piling up, showing consumers are increasingly worried and becoming more cautious with their spending. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
All right, let's do the numbers. The FTSE in London is down 0.9%. Germany's DAX is down 1.7%. Japan's Nikkei closed down more than 4%. Over here in the U.S., the Dow is down 0.1%. The S&P 500 is down a full percent. The NASDAQ is down just about 2%. And the yield on the 10-year Treasury is 4.22%. President Trump is also threatening more tariffs on goods from countries that buy Russian oil. That is, he says, if Russian President Vladimir Putin prevents a ceasefire deal with Ukraine from going through. The main countries that buy Russian oil are China and India. Trump told NBC's Meet the Press these tariffs would be between 25 and 50%. West Texas Intermediate is up 2%.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Certified Financial Planner Professionals. CFP professionals are committed to acting in their clients' best interest. Learn more about CFP professionals at letsmakeaplan.org. And by Commvault. When companies face ransomware and outages, they can recover data and business in just minutes with Commvault.
Up next, are you thinking of starting your own business? 5.2 million new businesses have been created in the past 5 years in a surge of entrepreneurship that started at the beginning of the pandemic. My colleague David Brancaccio spoke with Yaneli Espinal about this. She's host of Marketplace's financial literacy video podcast, Financially Inclined. That's where Yaneli offers money lessons mainly for younger people, but a lot of what she covers is useful for everyone. One recent episode was on starting your own business, something Yaneli has done herself.
I think I would consider myself what's technically called like a hobby-based entrepreneur. I wasn't really looking to make money or anything. I just wanted to make videos on YouTube about financial literacy because I was learning a lot about it on my own. And then the audience kind of grew. And so I was like, oh, maybe I should formalize this business.
You get a choice. You could be like a Schedule C person who does their business on their regular tax form, or you could become a corporation. You could be a sole proprietor, and then there's the LLC. Give us a sense of the difference.
Yeah, you know what? I think for most people, they're going to look for the easiest way to get started, and that's going to be sole proprietorship. It is definitely the easiest and cheapest option because you don't have to do anything like in terms of formal legal steps. But at the same time, there's zero personal protection. But if you're just starting out and you're just trying to test an idea, it's okay to just start as a sole proprietorship and start learning. And then if you decide later you want to make this more official, you can go ahead then and get like all the protections from an LLC. And that allows you to basically say, hey, if somebody sues the business, they're suing the business, which is a separate entity than me as a person.
You were having a conversation in a recent episode of Financially Inclined with a lawyer and entrepreneur who had some important advice connected to, you know, your time is worth something. Tell me about what you learned.
I was speaking to Sam Vander Wielen. She's an entrepreneur. She's also a lawyer. When Sam was talking to me, one of the key things I learned from her was, hey, take your business seriously. You know, if you have a business and you want it to actually be treated as a real business, then you have to run it like a real business. You have to open up a business bank account separate from your personal bank accounts. You have to separate those business expenses. And then she talks about business insurance and protecting your business, setting up a license if you need a license to run your business and things like that. And her piece of advice that I really loved was that, again, treating your business as a legit business and operating as a legit business involves like contracts and policies. You know, when I go shopping at any major retailer, they make their return policy so clear to me. And that's a way of protecting your business.
You know, you can get help by watching your financial literacy video podcast, Financially Inclined. But also, you know, the United States supposedly encourages entrepreneurship, and there's quite a few resources that people really should consider and consult.
Definitely, there are. There's, you know, college entrepreneurship initiatives. There are small business associations at the state level, absolutely, even at the city level. Check initiatives through your mayor's office. I mean, there's just so many in terms of local government because they want to encourage small business in their cities, in their states. Local bar associations will help because of all the legalities that you want to make sure you're doing properly with business. Women-owned business or minority-owned business, check for women or minority business associations as well. Or, you know, obviously, if you have a little bit of money set aside that you want to invest in your business, hiring a CPA 100% is super, super important because getting your bookkeeping, getting your accounting, getting your tax stuff set up properly is critical for the longevity of your business.
I know. Once you start getting into like depreciation of assets, I start to need serious help.
I don't want to do that by myself. No, thank you.
All right. Yanely Espinal hosts Marketplace's financial literacy video podcast, Financially Inclined. Latest episode, Entering Your Entrepreneur Era, is out now, and you can find it on our website, marketplace.org. Yanely, it's always good to catch up.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yanely was speaking there with Marketplace's David Brancaccio. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
There's a saying old says that love is blind. Still, we're often told, seek and ye shall find. So I'm going to seek a certain lad I've had in mind. Looking everywhere, haven't found him yet. He's the big affair I can